All right, Greg Neese once again asked me to extend his thanksgiving for our prayers. He got a knee replacement, and he had his first 2 days of therapy, which he found out weren't fun. And he said they were pushing me pretty hard, and he said towards the end of it, he said, I was about to burst into tears. I said, yeah, I know that. I've been through physical therapy, and it's not fun, but said, you'll be glad when you're through with it and all that. And so he wanted to once again convey his gratitude for our prayers and support. Also, again, I mentioned during first session, actually, that probably, you know, once a quarter or so, I'm going to give you a Sunday off, just so, you know, people want to plan. I'll try to give you more headway, more leeway, advance notice, so you can plan if you want to do something that weekend, or have a weekend out of town or something, so take a three-day weekend. A lot of times, you know, of course, we've got it coming up now, and I just took one, so I won't in May, but Memorial Day is a great day for that, but everybody gets kind of a three-day weekend anyway. So at any rate, just to let you know, I'll try to give you more headway, but I'd kind of hit the wall, and I really wasn't up to it at all. So not getting vacations can be difficult long-term, but you just have to deal with it. All right, well, let's make sure you are in fellowship here, and let's continue on with this doctrine of giving, grace giving. We are under Roman numeral 9, subpoint E. In order to understand the results and blessing, you've got to understand sowing and reaping governs this. And the sowing and reaping law, subpoint 2, is based on the fact that God decreed that the world would be a place of cause and effect. And that's one of the things that science, of course, is based on, the knowledge that for every effect, there had to be a preceding cause, that things don't happen in a vacuum. And so there had to be, this was one of the reasons, whether he, I don't know, think he was a believer, but I think it was Aristotle that called God the unmoved mover, that he is the original cause of all things. And so, even in philosophy, they could figure certain things out, but that doesn't mean they were saved. So the law indicates that the more one sows, that is, gives in certain contexts, the more one will reap, that is, to prosper and profit financially and spiritually. And again, people can focus on the physical aspects of this, that, okay, if I'm generous with God, he'll be generous with me, and that's fine and good, but you have to watch. One of the things is that people can get their motivation skewed, and then it becomes kind of like Jacob tried with the Lord when he was leaving Canaan there on his way out running from Esau. He said, if you'll be with me and bless me and blah, 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 then I'll serve you. Well, God doesn't make those kind of deals. He doesn't have to do something. You either serve God or you don't. And God's not going to bargain about it. And say, oh, well, yeah, if you want to serve me, fine. And but there's the physical component, but there's also the spiritual aspect of this, that this is an act that, number one, overrides the sin nature with its natural tendency towards selfishness and being self-centered and wanting to keep all of that. So there are, again, multiple benefits to this, both spiritually and financially. But if people go at this with the, I'm going to give so God will give to me, that motivation's probably wrong. That's not to be the motivation. Whether God gives back to you or not, if it's grace giving, there's no expectation of return, right? There shouldn't be. Other than God's normal function and what he's revealed himself to, okay, I will recompense. He is a God of recompenses, in fact, paybacks. But we want to be on the good side of the paybacks. So this law explains, at least in part, why some believers prosper and some do not. It is too simplistic to say that if people don't give sufficiently, that explains some of their financial difficulties. It could. It's not saying it can't. I'm just saying don't presume that's always the case. This is, and of course, this is another one of the factors that we've talked about in this, is the lack of judging. We don't judge other people with what they do on this. This has to be their priesthood before the Lord, and they'll answer for it. So being involved is, doesn't necessarily help us with that aspect of it. we don't want to get overly involved in people's lives where we're judging their applications or, quote, lack thereof. We don't fully know the situation, and that's why God says wait until the time. Wait until the judgment, when everything will be brought forward and God will judge all men according to all the knowledge he has. We don't have all the facts. So Solomon taught this principle, Proverbs 11, 24 and 25. There is one who scatters and yet increases all the more. Another bit of irony here for us. And the scatterer is the one who is giving, sowing seed as it were. And yet he prospers more. And there is one who withholds what is justly due. And yet it results only in want. In a sense, all of us are to be, in this regard, PVC pipes. You're just a PVC. You're just a funnel or a route for the blessings of God to flow into this world through you, through me. And cutting off, putting on the stop valve, turned it off. Well, guess what? It's going to have effects down the road too in your life. So the generous man will be prosperous. And he who waters will himself be watered. He who withholds grain, the people will curse him. But blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. So, again, these are some of those verses that have to do more with money than with salvation and people's relationship to money. Jesus taught this principle using slightly different language. Luke, this one you might know by heart, Luke 6:38. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over is the actual Greek of it, but they will pour into your lap. Again, they are unidentified. Agents that God uses to provide blessing for his people. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. And so the principle again here of sowing and reaping is still seen again. Whatever standard you use to sow, that's the standard that's going to be used for reaping. 7, God has promised to supply each believer with the financial resources to apply in this area. Again, the amount of the resources don't matter. Everything in life begins small, frankly. There isn't anything in this world that really comes into this world in a full-blown way. 2 Corinthians 9, and I know we've seen this verse before, but this is the one with all the alls, I think. This isn't the other one. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. And that's why, you know, whether people determine that they are going to function under giving. And as we know, there's a spiritual gift of this as well. It's not everybody's spiritual gift. But like all the spiritual gifts, there are commands to function under each of the gifts, even though it's, quote, not yours. Every one of those things in Romans 12 there, every one of those permanent gifts has a place where it's commanded of believers in the New Testament. So he'll increase the harvest of your righteousness. And so other people give, say, they decide, okay, I want to give a set amount. $10 a week or whatever it is. Pick a number. I don't care what it is. Or they say, I want to do a percentage. I'll figure out what percentage I can deal with here. And obviously that percentage should be chosen first. You know kind of what your basic needs are and all that. And so that has to be chosen first. God has to be put in the first priority. But whatever you do, and usually about Christmas time or first of the year, a lot of times, I'll bring up the matter of giving. That, hey, Once a year, you should evaluate what you're doing or so. This is good sense in any area of life. But evaluate what you're doing and seek to increase it. And see what God does. If you're faithful with a little, and then God stretches. One of the things God does is He bless you by stretching your money. You end up sometimes at a place where there's some blessing you didn't anticipate. I know I was out. I wasn't even planning on it, but I was out. This must have been like the week before Easter, I guess. Probably during that week sometime. I think Linda had a dental appointment it was. And so I happened to run over to Aldi because it just happened to be right across the street. And we get several things from there because they're like cheaper. $2.29 for eggs instead of $8. Or whatever Publix is charging now. I think they're still around $5. $1.29 for a loaf of bread instead of $2.80. So there are certain things, you know, fruit's cheaper there. In some ways, you got to watch the fruit. But certain things are good. And so I went over there and I thought, oh, I'll just look in the frozen food. Well, they had marked their hams down like 60%. And whatever they were before, I don't remember. But I think I ended up paying like 90 cents a pound or something for spiral sliced hams. And so I grabbed a couple of those. So gave one of them away and kept the other one. But that was a great deal. And so, you know, if you're, just, you pray about it when you shop, or at least I do. Hopefully everybody does. God bless my shopping basket. Help me to find what I need. Help me. I used to be, as I've told you before, way more frugal, and I always bought just whatever was the cheapest thing because I figure, well, I don't really care. I never really invested in any kind of quality clothing or anything like that. Well, they all wore out fast, and you know, they weren't good. And so I ended up maybe buying more, spending more than I would have had I bought a quality item. So I came to learn, and a lot of this happened through the book of Ecclesiastes. My attitude and all began to change because I was always busy saving up, like most of us, we're baby boomers, came up thinking, okay, I got to take care of myself. We're taught to be self-reliant. These are good qualities, by the way, too. I'm not demeaning this in any way. To be self-reliant, to plan for yourself. My dad told me there's no such thing as a free lunch. You want something, you got to work for it. And those are all good qualities to instill in people. Those are actually biblical qualities that you have. But I always just thought, well, I'm just going to save and save and save. And I never would spend anything on myself. I didn't like spending anything on the family if I didn't have to. Well, that attitude was kind of wrong. And the way it got through to me was when he said, I've been wise, I've done all this, and what's going to happen to my stuff now when I die? And he said, there's every good chance I'll leave it to an idiot. And I began to think, what am I saving and denying myself everything for? Now, you can go to another extreme, obviously, and you indulge yourself with only the high. I've met some believers like this. Only the highest and the best will do. And that's not true either. So there may be a time for buying the highest and the best. There may be a time to buy the cheaper item. There may be a time to look for something in the middle of the road. It doesn't have to have every bell or whistle in order to do what you need it to do. And so I kind of learned, okay, well, it's not wrong to spend money on yourself. In fact, you probably need to at some level to maintain a good attitude about it. You're worthy of your money just as well as anybody else is. Not that we're against helping people, of course, we're not. So the logical outcome of this provision here, of more seed to sow, is that it results in a greater harvest. 9:8, just a couple of verses before that. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having always all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good need. And then the next two verses, 10 and 11, we just read. So the harvest encompasses both the phase two blessings and the promise of eternal surpassing grace rewards. We've looked at Luke 6:38, but let's look at Luke 12:32. And that ought to be as much as our focus. The eternal aspects of this, the spiritual aspects of this. And so sometime when you're, this is a good verse for when you're really down on yourself and you think you're not worthy. You may not be, but this is a good verse. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to charity. Make yourselves money belts, which do not wear out. an unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near, nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And unfortunately for many people, their treasure is in this present evil age. That's where their treasure is. And that's where their heart is, unfortunately. It's with this world. We're going to have, that will be a while before we get to it, but this guy, Demas, who at one time was oriented, but he got enamored with the spirit of the age and abandons Paul and runs off to go do whatever he chooses to do. But the implications from what Paul said was it wasn't good that he was a spiritual casualty. And so, we don't want to be that. So again, where your treasure is, what your focus is on. I find more and more, we were discussing it yesterday, in fact, cutting the cable, getting rid of the TV, and I started looking and I thought, you can get enough free TV out there. The only problem I have is I can't get any local news or weather if we do this. But there may be a way around that even too. But at any rate, trying to do that because I realize we just don't watch TV as much anymore. We don't have time for it or pay attention to it. And not that we don't enjoy being entertained. I like being entertained. Entertain me. You know. But as well as the next guy, but it's not what it was when you're younger. You see, number one, it isn't satisfying long term. You can watch your favorite show, binge watch everything for days. And at the end of it, how are you going to feel? A whole lot better spiritually? Probably not. Well, the enemies of grace giving, number 10 here, the primary enemy of all doctrine is the indwelling sin nature, which is always in conflict with the Holy Spirit and resident doctrine. Galatians chapter 5. For the flesh. Hasarks, Paul's terminology for the old sin nature, essentially because the old sin nature resides in the genetics of your flesh. Those born with an old sin nature, which by the way was everyone except Jesus, are judged with spiritual death at the point of physical birth. They have to be. Because and Paul's very plain on this in Romans 5 there, out of spiritual death comes sins. Sins don't produce spiritual death. Sins are the outflow of spiritual death. Just as an apple doesn't produce a tree, the tree produces the apple. It's the other way around. So 5:17, the flesh sets its desire. Epithumia is a word for strong desire, or sometimes it's even translated lust. The flesh lusts against the spirit, but sets its desires better because lust may have the concept, the added idea of sexual desire, but that's not it. It's the flesh very strongly combats against the spirit. His desire is against what the spirit wants. And the spirit has this strong desire against the flesh. For these are in opposition to one another. They lie opposite, so that you may not do the things you please. Because let's face it, if you're a positive believer, and hopefully if you're a believer at all, but I don't know that it governs other believers sometimes. But generally speaking, you should want to know what the Spirit wants and want to do that. But having the sin nature mandates you're not going to be able to do it all the time. You're going to fail. The sin nature is going to win from time to time. Our job is just seeking to keep it from winning any more than it does. To try to keep it in check. To deny ourselves. Take up the cross and follow him to the suffering. And so then, on the other hand, the flesh wants to do certain things and the spirit thwarts him. The flesh may want to do certain things and all of that, and the spirit sends out the impulse, no, don't want to do this. And it combats the flesh. So you've got this inner conflict that's going on all the time, the constant inner conflict. It may wax and it may wane, but it's always going to be going on at some level, whatever level. And then 1 Peter, also 2:11. And here he talks about it in terms of the soul, not so much the spirit, as the soul, which is the real you. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust. Apekomai has the idea, apeko, to hold yourself back, to have away from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. And here the soul may just be a figure too for you. You could just substitute the wage war against you because you're the object of this war. Your soul is the battlefield where this takes place. And it's not in your best interest for the old sin nature to win. Fleshly lusts here they're called, but that comes from sarkikos, comes from the noun sarx. This is fleshly lusts. So old sin nature lusts. So what are the lusts of the old sin nature? We can't find them. We don't know. No, Galatians 5 tells us exactly what they are. There's another, and then these vice lists that are found in the Bible. Matter of fact, go back to Galatians there. These vice lists that are found are good for categorizing certain things. And so we don't have to wonder about how the flesh manifests itself. The deeds, verse 19, the deeds of the flesh are evident. Immorality, impurity, sensuality, those all have a sexual component, sexual deviance. And now we've got to where normal sexual deviance isn't enough for our world. We have to have abnormal sexual deviance shoved down our throat. In every program, I see it more and more and more. They're absolutely cramming down your minds and your ideas this idea of sexual deviance. Lesbianism, homosexuality, transgender stuff, people thinking God doesn't know what a human soul is or how to put it in a body. He's done all right for centuries here, millennia, but now God doesn't know. All the blasphemy that, and I see more and more and more, it's in the shows that used to never reference it. And some shows have been a long time, like Grey's Anatomy. It's gotten so horrible, you can't even watch it. And, you know, also, of course, a lot of them left. So 2:11 here, or I'm sorry, 5. Now, you got the sexual component, idolatry, sorcery. Those are religious reversionism type things. Sorcery, the idea of using spells, incantations, these types of things in order to, and it's usually done for two reasons. One is so you can live the good life. It's for you. I want to live the good life, and so I want these spells to help me, these crystals, these whatever people engage in, all that. Or it's to harm your enemy. I want to cast a spell on them so they get hurt. And so that's that. Idolatry is the worship of things other than God's. Then you get into the anger complex, enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, dissensions, disputes, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these, of which I forewarn you just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. And then he goes on to provide for us the fruit of the Spirit, the unified type of behavior that should govern a believer walking in fellowship, love, peace, joy, and all that. So when the old man, the old sin nature is placed in the position of rulership, the lusts that proceed from the old man may incite believers to maladjust in any area. Romans 6:19. And Paul here contrasts. He says, I'm speaking in human terms. I'm trying to tone this down to make it as simple as I can here for you at some level because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves to impurity and lawlessness, the pre-salvation state of the unbeliever is that whatever the lusts of the old sin nature crank out, that's what they do. They don't have any ability, any mechanic, any strength to withstand this. And so, as unbelievers, when we see them out there acting like idiots and doing stupid stuff, we should never be shocked. This is all they can do. They don't have the law of God. They don't understand God. They don't experience the grace of God, or they may just experience it in a general sense. But they're not pursuing it. And so, as unbelievers, that's all they can do. They can just continue to live in this lifestyle that goes nowhere. until that is broken by an outside force greater than the old sin. It has to be more powerful than the old sin nature, by the way. So now that you're believers, present your members as slaves to righteousness, resulting in sanctification. This is spiritual growth. For when you were slaves of the old sin nature. Again, the language in Romans is, Paul has a very distinct way. Hey, hamartia. He always uses that definite article when he's referring to the sin nature. And that this is the pre-salvation state of all unbelievers. Slaves to their sin nature. You were free from the righteous nature. See, you didn't have a righteous nature at that point, unfortunately. But now we have a new righteous nature, the new man. And then also chapter 7 there, verse 5. And again, looking at this from the status of the pre-salvation condition, for while we were in the flesh is his technical way of talking about the pre-salvation state. The sinful passions, which were aroused by the law, and of course this was, studying Romans was really fascinating because the law is implicated in sin in some ways. Not because there's any problem with the law, but the law stirs up the old sin nature. What is the quickest way to get somebody to do something? Tell them they can't. And they'll do it just to show you wrong, if nothing else. Just to prove you're wrong. But that's one way to motivate people. Well, when the law says, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, the sin nature says, want to bet? I can too. I can do this. So the law, of course, this group of commandments, worked against us in that it's like the little grass on the sign on the grass. Stay off the grass. Well, somebody's got to cut across it. You just have to. So the law stirs up the old sin nature. And this was at work in the members of our body to bear fruit for death. And of course, again, the unbeliever, he has no capacity or ability other than just maybe what's in his own character to say no. But most of the time he can't say no to the sin nature because it's what he wants. It's his lifestyle. It's what he's chosen. So see here specific areas of the lust grid that may adversely impact application under grace giving. Obviously, this more broad one here, selfishness, self-gratification, or the lack of proper concern. James chapter 4. And James minces no words here. He spells this out very clearly. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Why can't people get along? I can tell you why they can't get along. They both want their way. That's why they're not getting along. I want my way, you want your way. There we go. And that's the way it is unless one or both yield and decide, okay, I don't have to have my way. So is not the source. The source of these conflicts, your pleasures that wage war in your members. Your desires to please yourself, to serve yourself, that fight against the Christian life. You lust and you do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. That's one problem with people is they don't approach God first. They don't make it a matter of prayer. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasure. God, I just want to pray that you'd let me win the lottery because, I can give a lot of money to the church then. Now, I won't want anything for me, of course. I don't think that's the way it works. That is a naive view of that. Also, 1 John 3, 17 and 18. Here, and now a lack of proper concern. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need. Now we're commanded, of course, in other places, not here, but Paul says, do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. John here focuses on the household of faith. He's not looking at the big, broader picture. It's seeing your spiritual, your Christian brother in need. And closes his heart against him. How does the love of God abide in him? The implication of this question is that it doesn't. How do you justify that? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and in truth. And word apparently contrasts with deed. In other words, it's the opposite of doing something. You just say it. And tongue appears to contrast with truth, suggesting you're saying you're concerned, but you're really not. You're really not all that concerned. Your concern is go in peace, be warmed, be filled. That's the level of concern, which James says is worthless. Fear, that's one of the reasons. If I give, I won't have enough for me. God won't take care of me. Well, that fear comes born right out of the idea of unbelief. You don't trust God to take care of you. And that's scary, and people say, well, it's easy to trust God when you have money. So, I don't think it is. I think it's difficult to trust God for everybody because we have to overrule our natural tendencies, the cosmos, even what we're seeing in the church in terms of its pursuit of money and the details of life and all that. Trying to get ahead in this world. Well, for this reason, I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food? I mean, really, is that how you can, you know, you just watch the food channel, nothing else, that's it? Food TV? No, and you don't consider your meal to be your life, do you? I mean, obviously, we have to eat. We have to have nourishment. We have to put nutrition in the body. But is that really what life's about? For some people, they call them foodies. That's all their life's about. Where they're going to get their next meal. What's it going to be? Is it going to be something great? Am I going to go do a 50-course tasting menu? Whatever that would cost. Because you know it would be expensive. So no, your life isn't your life more than food? And the implication, of course, is that it is. And isn't your body more than just clothing? So we look at the birds of the air. God takes care of lower creation. Does he not? Do you not think he will take care of you? And that's the answer. That's the question he asks at the end of verse 26. Are you not worth much more than they? Do you consider the birds out there flying around more? Well, maybe if you're from PETA, you do. But I don't. I don't think animals are worth what humans are worth at all in any shape, form, or fashion. They're not even to be put into the same scale. That's ludicrous. That's a failure to understand the different types of life God has created. I think humans are more valuable than grass and trees and the spotted owl. And, you know, we're not advocating go out and destroy the environment or trash protected species. What we're saying is, why are we protecting the alligator in Florida? That's one of my questions. Why are we doing that? While they're killing people and pets and animals. See, I think a man's pet's more valuable than an alligator. Because an alligator's a wild creature. And they're kind of destructive, if you've ever noticed. They're not really good neighbors. I do believe animals are far less important than humans. And so I know some people out there, and maybe not here, but some people out there in the cosmos don't. So fear. I'm afraid God won't take care of me. I'm afraid he won't supply. Approbation lust. This is an enemy. Matthew 6, one, the same chapter there, just back up to the beginning. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and the streets, so that they may be honored by men. They want people to look up. They want approbation. They want to be liked. They want to feel like they're impressive to people. And people are impressed with them. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Secrecy, privacy. Obviously, this takes it to an extreme. Your left hand knows what your right hand's doing. Hopefully your hands work in combination with one another and they're not just independent agents there at the end of your arms. So that your giving will be in secret. And when your Father who sees what is done in secret, he will reward you. And so again, you have to have your focus on why am I doing this? One, I'm not doing it so people will be impressed with me. But that's a part of human nature, to want people to be impressed with you, to like you, and all that. Also, Acts 5. Here we have a negative example, in fact. Acts 5, 1 and following. And again, the backdrop to this has to be, you have to take in kind of the end of chapter 4 there. That in the beginning stages of the church, there was not a needy person, verse 34, among them. For all who were owners of lands or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales, and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each as any had need. Now Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles, which translated means son of encouragement, who owned a tract of land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. Well, a man named Ananias, with his wife Sapphira, sold a piece of property and kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's full knowledge. They were in on this. They were partners in crime here. And bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. The implication was they'd sold it and brought all the proceeds just like everybody else was doing. But they tried to cut some corners. They wanted to keep some of the money for themselves. And so Peter said, "Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you have conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God." And as he heard these words, Ananias fell down and breathed his last. And great fear came over all who heard it. Oh, I bet they did. I bet I'd be scared. Wait a second, God's killing people now? Because he tried to scam the church? Yeah. Tried to pull off and make it look like he was doing this for approbation so people would think highly of him and his wife. And then, of course, you've got to know, when people ask questions, his wife Sapphira should have known this. Peter's asking either because he knows or because he doesn't know. But you better figure out real quick which. And he knows. And after an interval of 3 hours, verse 7, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. And Peter responded to her, "Tell me whether you sold the land for such and such a price." And she said, "Yes, that was the price." And Peter said to her, she lied, of course, "Why is it that you have agreed together to put the Spirit of the Lord to the test? Behold, the feet of those who buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out as well." And immediately she fell at his feet and breathed her last. And the young men came in and found her dead. And they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear came over the whole church. Well, nobody's going to try that again for a while. That sends a message. You tell me punishment isn't a deterrent. This is a deterrent. People were scared. And right, so the fear of God should be in them on this. Because they were trying to scam the church, the apostles. And of course, he made it personal. You tried to scam the Lord. And God's not impressed with that. The love of money, that in and of itself can get people into trouble. Some people just love money, which we know is a root of all sorts of evil. Matthew 6:24. No man can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other. He will be devoted to one, and he will despise the other. You cannot serve God and money, wealth. There's just no way the two are like oil and water. They're not going to mix. If money and the details and getting ahead is all you're about, living the good life, if God provides you the good life, we're all fine with that. If he doesn't and you have to pursue it and you're constantly compromising doctrine to get it, well, we're not fine with that. The body should demonstrate its disapproval of that type of lifestyle. We don't want that at all. So you can't serve God and money. Some people love money. That's just the bottom line. They're more worried about money. They talk about money. They talk about their details. They're busy planning their trips. And again, we're not against people taking vacations or going places or having trips. God can bless people with all that. And he does. But to say, "I've got to have the highest and the best," I'm not going to go on a trip. I'm going to take that 3-year cruise, or is it a year or 3 years, whatever it is. You get on a boat for 3 years or whatever. Who would want to do that? Stuck on a boat for 3 years. I mean, I guess you get off at ports and stuff, but you get to see the whole world, I suppose. But, you know, when I calculate out, the price actually wasn't bad. I don't know that you could live at home for that cheap. But there's lots of tips and stuff. Well, avarice or stinginess, greed. 2 Corinthians, greed means I need more. How much is enough? It's never enough. That was a beautiful line out of Wall Street. When's it enough? It's never enough. The next deal, the next million, the next thing. 2 Corinthians 9, 5 through 7. So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers that they would go ahead of you and arrange beforehand your previously promised bountiful gift, so that the same would be ready as a bountiful gift and not affected by covetousness. Now this I say, he who sows sparingly, we've seen this, reaps sparingly. And he who sows bountifully will reap bountifully. But you've got to do as you figure it out in your heart. But again, the idea is that this can be affected by greed. My desire to want more is going to affect my desire to want to help you or give as I should in other situations. So greed can be a problem, avarice or greed. 6, unbelief with respect to the promises associated with grace giving may cause the unbeliever to be less than excited about applying. Romans 4:20. And this is Abraham as an example, not specifically with regard to giving, but as an example in general. And yet with respect to the promise of God. He did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving glory to God. Well, when we're tested and tempted, their test is to give in, to fail to believe, to question God, to doubt Him. And of course, the demons and all the spirits of the angelic conflict that are allied against us, they're quick to exploit these types of situations. Yeah, you're right. God's not going to take care of you. That may be where the original suggestion came from. Some demon whispered to you, God's not going to take care of you. Did you think that? Because we know that people's minds get influenced by demons. Even believers' minds get influenced. They can't be possessed. I get that. But do demons influence our thinking? Yes, that's why we have apostasy. One of the reasons, 1 Timothy 4 there. They began to pay attention to deceitful spirits. And why did they start paying attention to them? Because they got their attention. So the spirits, the forces of evil, have ways of getting people's attention. And then passing their thoughts on to the human race. And then, of course, once they get somebody captive, then they can use him as a simple pawn in their game to continue to advocate false doctrines, erroneous teachings, all that. Well, D, while not specifically sinful, other types of activities and rationales may undermine the proper function in this area of the Christian life. 1, procrastination. Now, this is a general problem sometimes for people. Proverbs 3:28. But specifically in this context with giving, I want to put things off. I've got a list of things a lot of times at home, and that list is constantly changing. But I look at the list some days and I just think, I'm not doing anything. I'm not doing it today. And I put it off. And if you do that long enough, your roof will fall in. That's one of the warnings, I believe, in Ecclesiastes. That if you put stuff off too long, you have real problems. But here, Proverbs 3:28. Do not say to your neighbor. This is when he comes to you and asks for help. Do not say, go and come back. And tomorrow I will give it, when you have it with you. Now, maybe this is procrastination, or maybe you're just being cruel, but either way, it's not good. That's not what you want to do. 2, growing weary of doing good to others. That may not respond in an appropriate fashion. I think there's a part of us, I know I think this way a little bit, that when you do things for people, you kind of expect gratitude. Now, we're obviously not going to run around. You've got to thank everybody every time they do anything for you. It's not a bad habit, expressing gratitude. I'm grateful for that. But then over the years, and this gets into, for those of us who've been at this a long time, you've run the race for a while, and you've seen people not respond right under this, not take money, disappear. I've seen that kind of stuff, just horrible stuff that you wouldn't expect. But then there are people that they act like they expect you to do it. That's another whole thing that's very off-putting. That first, it's a grace operation. It can't be expected. It's not mandated. I mean, we're mandated to do it, but the cosmos or whoever's in need can't mandate that we do it. This has to be, again, free will operation. Galatians 6, 9, and 10. Do not lose heart in doing good. For in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. And some of the time it may not just be that the person isn't particularly grateful or whatever it was, but that you've had to do it so much. I've had to make this application over and over and over and over again. And I'm tired of doing this. Let somebody else do it. That's one of the things. I've heard that rationale. I've applied enough. Really? How do you determine that, and who's the judge of that? You may think you've applied enough, but here's the deal. If you're growing weary in it, why? Then ask yourself, why am I weary of this? And certain things, when you do it over and over and over again, yeah, it does wear on you. I understand that. But we have to say, okay, look, how many times did Jesus have to apply when he didn't feel like it in order to maintain his sinless status? How much nonsense did he put up with? So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially to those who are of the household of the faith. So we don't want to ever tire of this. Soul fainting, that's a loss of confidence, fatigue from running the race, 6-9, we just saw that. That's also alluded to, of course, soul fainting in Hebrews 12. Excessive debt, which manifests financial irresponsibility. Such is merely the manifestation of distorted priorities, selfishness, and greed. Psalm, actually, 37. The wicked borrows and does not pay back. And that's another whole lesson too in this, is that if you borrow, somebody loans you something, you're responsible for that. You're responsible to return it. If you borrow money, certainly you're responsible to pay him back. But say you borrow one of their implements, a hoe, a shovel, a rake, a lawnmower, a weed eater, whatever you might need, snowblower. I probably won't have to borrow that here. You borrow it. You're responsible for it. You break it. It's damaged in any way. You're responsible to fix it. This isn't optional. This is how righteous people live and act. They don't have to be told this. But the righteous, he is gracious and he gives. He's ready to deal with that. Well, our time is gone. I got more to say on this one, so we're going to go ahead and just stop there in our finances again and be ready here for Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We thank you for the grace you continue to extend to us, and pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.